from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Jane Allison, whose new book for writers is Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative, published by Catapult. Jane Allison was born in 1961 in Canberra, Australia, and until she was 11, grew up in the Australian and U.S. diplomatic services. She went to public schools in Washington, D.C., and studied classics at Princeton and Brown universities, and creative writing at Columbia. Before writing fiction, she worked for the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Washington City Paper, the Miami New Times, and Tulane University. She has also been a freelance editor and illustrator. Since 2013, she's been a professor of creative writing at the University of Virginia. Her first novel, The Love Artist, was published in 2001 and has been translated into 7 languages. It was followed by 3 further novels, The Marriage of the Sea, Natives and Exotics, and a nonfiction novel, Nine Island. She has also published a memoir, The Sisters Antipodes, translations of Ovid's stories of sexual transformation, Change Me, and her newest, which we talked about for this interview, Meander, Spiral, Explode. She has collaborated with composer Thomas Sleeper on a mini opera, and a song cycle based on her books, and her short fiction and essays have appeared in the Paris Review, New York Times, Washington Post, International Herald Tribune, Boston Globe, Creative Nonfiction, Tri-Quarterly, Germanic Review, and elsewhere. She lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. As Jane Allison writes in the introduction to her insightful and appealing book about the craft of writing, for centuries, there's been one path through fiction we're most likely to travel, one we're actually told to follow, and that's the dramatic arc. A situation arises, grows tense, reaches a peak, subsides. But something that swells and tautens until climax, then collapses, bit masculosexual, no? So many other patterns run through nature, tracing other deep motions in life. Why not draw on them, too? W. G. Zabald's Emigrants was the first novel to show Allison how forward momentum can be created by way of pattern rather than the traditional arc, or, in nature, wave. Other writers of non-linear prose considered in her Museum of Specimens include Nicholson Baker, Anne Carson, Marguerite Duras, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Jamaica Kincaid, among others. The interview begins with my first question to Jane, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. So I thought I would start by just reading a statement that you make early in the book, which is that neuroscientists have recorded the inner sensations of reading as, quote, a felt motionless movement through space. Once you've finished reading, that motionless movement leaves in your mind a numinous shape of the path you traveled, a river, roller coaster, wave. So that was really interesting to me. And I wondered if that study, when you found that statement, was part of the beginning of your journey into writing this book.
Actually, no, it wasn't. It was something I was really happy to come upon because it helped put into better words and more scientific language what I had been sort of grasping to express myself. Because I have a very strong feeling when I'm reading them that I'm in passages. I mean, they're not just written passages. They feel spatial to me. So to come across this study, and I hope I've got it referenced in the back of the book, just really sort of woke me up to the fact that I wasn't nuts. It is something that people have been able to detect.
Yeah. It resonated for me when I read that statement because I feel the same way, you know, and everybody always talks about how they lose themselves in reading. But I loved seeing that scientific explanation of it. And then I loved the introduction to the book and the whole primary elements chapter that sort of leads us in and explains some of what you don't like about, for example, the assumption that every narrative should follow the Aristotelian narrative arc. And it was kind of funny to me that you pointed out its masculosexual nature. you don't exactly dismiss that arc, but you do offer options for other structures, which is very freeing throughout the book. So I enjoyed that. And I just wonder if you can talk about writing that introduction, which was just an incredible explanation of your feelings on all of this.
Well, thank you. I think what it's true, because I am not opposed to the arc. For a while, I was starting to feel as though I had a polemic against it. And then I realized, no, what my argument is with people being taught that they should follow it. And I was at a conference in Kentucky just this past weekend, the Women Writers Conference, and I had a wonderful group of women in my workshop, and they, among them, were teachers at different levels, and they said, yep, it's true, I teach the arc. I tell people that they should follow Freytag's triangle. So it's really just that. It's the assumption that we should follow it, but still really does continue in a lot of places. Whereas I had found over reading, you know, for 20 years as a writer, that all sorts of texts that I had loved that did not follow that, they seemed to be doing something else. And so that's what really started the book, was first me realizing that there were other structures, there were more spatial structures that might do something a little bit more that involved the reader's way of putting together what's being presented rather than following a plot. I'd been reading books and stories that were doing different things for years, and I knew that I had sorted out ways that I saw the patterns working, but what I hadn't realized was that, interestingly to me, they seem to follow some of these core patterns in nature that I talk about in the book, and that the title follows, like meanders or spirals or explosive or radial shapes or cellular or network patterns. This was a shocking revelation, because I thought I knew what I was writing about, and then I realized I didn't know enough about patterns themselves. So I did some research, and this book by Peter Stevens from the 1970s just had me floored, because he is a brilliant scientist of design and nature and shape and organic growth, and he points out way back in the 70s that there are these recurrent shapes. And then I realized they happened to, the patterns I had found in books were aligning in a kind of rough way with those shapes. And that made me then re-look at the arc and see that it too was a natural shape, that it's a wave. And a wave is a wonderful, gorgeous thing. I can watch a wave break on the beach forever. But it is one, you know, it's one shape that we have all around us in nature, and there are these others too. So I wrote that introduction trying to kind of get that initial argument and really the history of the discovery out on the page, so people could see where this otherwise often it seemed to me wacky idea was coming from.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask a question about this later, but I feel like I've used structure in my own work to help me get grounded and to keep me focused and organized, rather than looking at it as necessarily important to the reader. And now reading this book, I'm like, well, that was silly. Of course, how I structure my work is going to be important to the reader. But it sometimes works out both ways. Do you find that as well?
That's really interesting. I think that I have, I'm not sure, even though I've been teaching forever, I'm not sure I've really thought about it as two separate ways of approaching the work. I think I'm kind of always half imagining a reader, even though we try not to, because that can be so inhibiting. But I think when I am working with structure, it's I'm sort of being the reader and the writer at once. It's a kind of dissolved moment when it's just, well, what is the thing that is holding this together and moving it forward, you know, that isn't just plain plot. So it's funny. I think I kind of toggle between being reader and writer all the time. I mean, I think writers always do that, because, you know, we are, that's what we are doing. We're reading our own work, trying to figure out what on earth we're writing.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to come back to that later, but I wanted to talk specifically about, you include in this book, as one of your examples, a story that I have always loved and been fascinated with and recommended and I go back to all the time, which is Tobias Wolff's Bullet in the Brain.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just such a weird story and kind of funny in a strange way, and also just really, I think, touching. But I loved that you focus on the text level about certain things that he's doing to kind of like hold us in a moment. And I think it's in your movement and flow section. And you kind of he holds us in this moment in time in which the narrator actually has been shot in the head and is about to be dead. I mean, certainly is dead, but there is this sort of synaptic moment where memory is explained and presented. And what he does, with which I've always found really interesting, is he talks a lot about what the narrator Anders does not remember, and that's a way into a lot of background on this person and his life. And those are the things he doesn't remember, and he kind of extends this moment in time. And then he comes in and he says, this is what he remembered: heat, a baseball field, yellow grass, the whir of insects, and on. And then your text says, do you hear that word heat? A single word, small as can be, but it takes up time. The long diphthong, the reconfiguration of my inner mouth to move from remembered to the opening H, another reconfiguration to move from that final T and onward, heat. This single word slows me, creates a lull between the act of remembering and what's remembered. This word clears a glade in the mind for the potent, lingering scene that will be Anders' final memory and the end of his story. And, you know, just taking that word and showing us what it does for the narrative was so wonderful. I've read the story 50 times, and I just loved that you did that for me, for me personally. and I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about using texts to explain your point of view on these subjects and getting down to the line level and helping us read them smarter, I guess I'll say.
I'm really glad you like that section. In fact, I was at the same workshop this weekend in Kentucky. We looked closely at that story, and people responded to it in just the same way you have, you know, the many times you read it. I think that's such a brilliant story because of so many things he's doing with respect to controlling time, because he moves through all of these different speeds, which is what makes excellent pacing. But then he does it for a reason, to get us to this fabulous moment when someone who is utterly hateful, the narratorial consciousness of the main character, Anders, he's lonesome, and he gets shot, and you might have thought, okay, so what? But then, you know, the way he freezes time, so we get that whole brilliant sequence of the things he doesn't remember, which is a backhanded way of giving summary of who he really was, to right. This really sweet moment he does remember. It just changes everything, and it makes it, as you say, a really touching story, and covering so much time and space in a very, very short couple of pages. And I think actually that moment of realizing that word heat, what it does, the way it slows things down, I think odds are very good that I had a poet in a class once who pointed that out. I probably should have credited this person. I don't really remember if that's true, but I think that's when I think I realized, oh, excellent. So poets, of course, are looking at speed and rhythm in a very different way from the way narrative writers more often do. And so it helped me break down the way I read text and feel time passing through me as I read text, based on really the most elementary particles. I originally studied classics. I did Latin and Greek, more Latin than Greek. And one of the great things about that is that if you're like me and you actually can't read it very fast at all, it slows you down so much. So reading, you know, translating a single line of Horace or a single line of Ovid or whoever, it really slows you down, and it makes you hear the words and see them on the page and deal with their meanings as well. And so I think when whoever this wonderful poet in the class was who kind of said the same thing about that word heat or another word like it, I think it made me think more about the connections between prose and poetry, which we can so often forget, which is that really it is the, you know, it's very, things can be broken down to that level of elementary, reception by us as we absorb the words, both looking and hearing them, looking at and hearing them. And I think working with texts, I think probably because I came to all of this from classics, where you really spend a lot of time looking at individual words and lines and meters and so on, that's probably, I'm more comfortable looking at English texts that way. I'm a little bit better at looking really, really closely at a few things rather than having a huge vast breadth of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe kind of a cop-out, but it also has its virtue of, you know, letting me feel like I can really begin to understand something pretty well and see all of the different bits of brilliance that have gone into making it, when it's something that can actually hold your attention for that long, that you can read it again and again the way you've read Bullet in the Brain.
Right, right. I think, too, reading your book helped me see that, of course, these authors know what they are doing. And sometimes, you know, I think that some books you read and you feel like it was mostly an act of, just kind of getting the words out on the page, getting the story out, and not necessarily coming down to the line level or to patterning, as we are about to talk about more. I suppose it's kind of naive, but I'm always blown away to see somebody explain or show me what an author was really doing when I've read something and thought, well, that was great, but I don't under, you know, like one example that I have in my questions for you is Stuart Dybeck's Pet Milk, which is in your spirals section. And, you know, to me, it's really obvious that Pet Milk is aware of its being about spirals, and there are, you know, I mean, he's embedded spirals in that story quite a bit.
Sure.
And so he knew what he was doing, and maybe I would have, I hadn't read that story before I read your book, but maybe I would have seen that and known that he knew what he was doing even without reading your chapter on it. But I loved having you guide me through it. So
I love that story. I adore that story. Every time I read it, I just love it again. Which is such a, that's one of the best things about writing and teaching, is you get to be in love again and again with some of the same works. It's funny, I feel that maybe it's a flaw of mine that I don't get bored with them, but I haven't.
No, well, I mean, if you find great work, it's wonderful to kind of linger in it and learn what you are appreciating on a kind of more, I don't know, granular basis or something.
Yeah.
Now, you write in this, you write that W.G. Zabald's novel, The Emigrants, was the first book that I think you said you, it shows you a way beyond the causal arc to create powerful forward motion in narrative. And I wondered if we could talk about that a little bit and what that book means to you.
Sure. So I was reading that book. I lived in Germany for 10 years with my then husband, who was a professor there of urban design. And I was trying to learn the language, and I had a book group with several German women, and because I wanted to make everything as hard for myself as I could. So all we did was talk German. And one of them suggested the Zabald, which I hadn't read yet. And so, and it was kind of like, it was not unlike translating the Latin or Greek, because I was pretty much just translating the German, which meant it went really slowly, which meant I could really think about it, which I think is, I mean, you know, we write slowly, and I think it's great when readers read slowly too, so that we can really absorb all of the decisions, or some of the decisions that have gone into each line. But the Zabald, it's for people who haven't read it, it was written in the, I think, 90s, and Zabald was a German, but he's not alive anymore, but he left Germany because he pretty much hated his home country and lived in England, but wrote a lot about Germany and Germans and people who had left it. And so The Emigrants is a set of four different narratives, all embedded in one novel, with the same narrator, and each of the narratives is about a man who left Germany. In three cases, they're Jewish, and the fourth not. But they all left Germany for a reason that has something to do with the Holocaust or with anti-Semitism, but he never uses those words. You never get the word Holocaust, and so it's just sort of steeped in that horror and that sadness. And so the four separate narratives, they just follow one man, or in each case he's either already killed himself or is going to, and so it's a kind of mystery to figure out who this man was and to reconstruct his life and to understand and just understand what he was and why he did what he did. And it's gloomy, but it's just gorgeous and so intricately detailed. And what was interesting to me reading it was that each narrative was more or less its own thing. It had the same narrator, but there was no kind of plotted connection from one narrative to the next. You had the same guy kind of roaming around the world trying to learn about these men. But there was nothing that you could say is making you go from one section to the next in terms of plot, or even or any kind of causality or any kind of temporal relationship. And so I kept thinking, what is making me go forward? I mean, yes, I'm mesmerized by these lines and by visions of these men and their lives, but why am I going from one to the next? What am I trying to get? And then I had realized, as one does pretty quickly, that there are lots of overlaps among the four sections, but the most interesting to me was the appearance of someone that Zabald calls the Butterfly Man. And the Butterfly Man appears first, actually, as a photo of Nabokov, as he is collecting butterflies, as he did, as a way of showing what another character looked like. And that, because there are photos in the book, I should add. And then he appears as a little boy collecting butterflies in the early 1900s, and elsewhere as a man with a butterfly net who appears out of nowhere to urge someone not to jump off a mountainside, as he's thinking of doing. So he appears in different ways, and that seemed to me to be sort of what was driving me most in reading the book, was to try and understand why he was in there and why he was appearing in different ways. So this book came to me, it occurred to me finally that this book was working on a very different level that had nothing to do with plot. It had to do with me trying to understand and make sense, given all of these clues I was being given, what held the whole book together. And that motion of trying to figure it out and then finally coming up with an idea, with a theory, is what gave the book its largest motion, you know, beyond the kind of mesmerizing features of each of the separate narratives. So I read that book very carefully many times and did lots of research on it and ended up with a theory about what how the book was working and how the Butterfly Man, specifically as Nabokov, was figuring in it to make of these four parts something much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. So then I began to do research on what had gone on and what was this phenomenon, and that led me to an essay by Joseph Frank from the 40s called, which is about spatial form and narrative. And then things began to click, and I realized, oh, there are other ways you can make a person be absolutely engrossed and feel as though she's moving forward, even though plot is not what's causing it.
Right. And you talk about that in the book. You talk about the reasons that a reader will move forward and that it might be plot, it might be time passing, it might be a motivation on the part of the narrator, lots of different things. And so do you feel like each of these different structures that you're talking about in the book kind of motivate readers in different ways, mostly?
That's a good question. I think every book, every story motivates you in a different way, right? So, I mean, unless you read exclusively, detective books, and I shouldn't say that because I don't read them, but I think that sometimes you're trying to figure out, like, for instance, a story like Joyce Carol Oates' Blackwater, which
yes.
is a kind of loose, or not very loose, but it's a reimagining of the Chappaquiddick incident with Teddy Kennedy.
Right.
And which is so funny because there's whole generations who have no idea what that means.
Right,
in my
isn't
classroom,
that...
I had to explain. Yeah, so the cutoff is, you know, they have to be about 35 years old, I think, for them to know what that means. But so something like that, where she will tell you immediately that this is the girl, she's in the car's gone into the water, she's going to drown and die. And you know that it's based on a real story, and you know horribly that it's going to happen, but she keeps delaying it and delaying it and delaying it, Joyce Phillips does. And so, you know, you end up reading it because horribly you both want to get to that gruesome end, and you don't, not yet. You know, you want to delay it and delay it yourself because, you know, you don't want her to die, and you do want to see who she was, and you do want the narrative to continue. We have a pleasure in being in the narrative. So that's what I call a kind of explosive or radial shape, because everything's already happened in the first sentence, and then it just keeps kind of expanding and contracting and expanding and contracting into visions of who she was and what, you know, what's happening at that very second. So that, in that case, the motivation is a very different thing from what it is, say, when I read Jamaica Kincaid's Mr. Potter,
mm-hmm.
where she is, as the author, kind of lightly veiled as the narrator, is more or less summoning to life a father she never knew. And there you have this kind of weird, slow, spiraling movement where she's being kind of incantatorily a witch and making this man come to life, even as she tells you that's what she's doing. So, so those are very different things that are operating. And now you're probably moving over the pages at the same kind of speed, but there's a different kind of speed going on in my mind as I'm trying to figure out, you know, in the case of the Jamaica Kincaid, you know, just what is she doing and who is this author? And, oh, my God, she actually is the character, and she's being a kind of god creating her own father. And so it's a kind of slow, you know, unraveling of an idea, as mm-hmm. opposed to the Joyce Carol Oates, where I'm both rushing and freezing at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me, it's funny, I hadn't thought about this while I was reading your book, but in just our conversation, it reminds me a little bit of the opening of Donna Tartt's The Secret History, where she announces immediately that this group of friends killed their friend. And,
oh, yeah.
And you know, and I don't know if that's, I haven't thought about it until this very moment, but, you know, is that maybe an explosive structure? I don't know. I'd have to look at it and think about it, but I love thinking about it. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And that's, I haven't read the book since it came out, but I remember that. And I remember the same sort of grim delight in watching it happen. You know, where
right.
you've been told what to expect. And it's working in a way like Greek tragedy or, you know, a play, because, you know, the story is already known. It's just, how is it going to be done? You know,
right.
what's the pleasure going to be in the rendering? And Garcia Marquez does something very similar in Chronicle of the Death Foretold, where you know someone's going to be killed, and by whom, on the first page. and then you have to wait 120 pages or whatever to see it happen, which you horribly want to see.
Yeah.
It's so manipulative.
It is. Now, I've been doing these interviews for a long time, and the subject of structure comes up, and I have been warned by authors against beginning with a structure already in mind. Now, I said I was going to get back to this. I had great luck actually writing with a structure in mind when I did a novel. I wrote a novel several years ago, and I structured it not on something in nature, but around a musical construct called the Circle of Fifths. Circle of Fifths, I'm not going to go into great detail, but for example, the key of C is also the same keys that are used in A minor. And so there each major key has a minor key associated with it. And I used that as a way of grounding myself in stories. And I wrote a series of stories that in my mind were associated with the Circle of Fifths. So, and that helped keep me grounded, and I really liked how it came out. And So I'm curious what your thoughts are on starting with a structure that you already have. And I've sort of ruined it because now I've given you what I think. But
well, you know, what were you thinking that one case? I'm actually really fascinated in this, and I'm going to need to read your book. And I'm always jealous of people who know about music because I find that's a kind of higher species of brain than I have. I think that, I mean, had you written anything? I mean, did the structure come absolutely first? Or had you written any sort of drafted some of it?
Right. So I had written a couple of little vignettes, or maybe they were almost stories, but they weren't standalone. They were about a town, and I knew I wanted to write 12 different stories. I didn't know they were going to be 12 until I thought about the structure, but I knew I was going to write from different characters' points of view in this town, and then I ended up putting the structure in there to kind of, because otherwise I go down all these different rabbit holes and it takes 12 years to write a novel. So, so I guess I had the idea for the book in place. Yes.
You had not just the idea, but a lot of the words already. I mean, do you think you stayed with the text you'd already written?
I had written two of the stories and those stayed, although maybe I manipulated them a little bit to fit better into the structure I had in mind, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, I can see it worked for you. what I hate is when someone says, you know, outline the book, because that means you're kind of short-circuiting all the imagination that comes from the kind of crazy process of writing.
Right.
But, you know, you don't write, I mean, I, before I wrote fiction or anything, like creative writing at all, I wrote, academic things and analytical things, and I would often have a lot of it in my mind all worked out before I would write it. And that is something that I used to be proud of. And now as a creative writer, I think I would not be proud of that if that's how I were writing creatively. But that is my process. I feel that I have to generate a lot of stuff that might just be junk, but, you know, I'll hear a character's voice, or I will see a place, or I will have a scene, and I'll just start putting that out there. And I have to have a certain kind of critical mass, not the whole thing, but a bunch of it before I can begin to see where I think the whole thing is going. If it's a plot, which it sometimes actually is, but not always, then I have to have some sense, not sorted out, but some sense, or I have to already know what the kind of, you know, more internal movements that I want, what those are. But I can't really do that until I've got a lot of the material, and some of it's going to be in my head only, but a lot of it's going to be on the page. Mm-hmm. And then I get really ruthless about structuring. You know, once I've got things sorted out, you know, in terms of the kind of emotional heart, then I kind of go in and start saying, okay, what's happening here? And this scene and so-and-so is being accomplished. So that means I need to, you know, parallel it with something else later. But to me, I have to have a lot of the sheer material somewhere, somehow, before I can do any structuring. Because all I know is that I've been trapped. I will think, oh, this is so cool. It's kind of falling into five parts, so why don't I make it a five-act play? And then I'll start to get this horrible feeling that I'm trapped because the structure is sitting on me. In the same way that feeling like I have to have, you know, a plotted arc and a climax just can feel so trapping. It's just like faking it. So I don't know. Yeah, structure has to start happening, you know, in conjunction with the flesh itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. And maybe I just like being trapped.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're a poet as well. And I don't mean that poets are crap, but sometimes when they, you know, they work with those gorgeous forms that are, you know, that have roles, and that can be incredibly liberating of other things.
Yeah. That's true. I don't write poetry, but I should try. Let's see. I wanted to read from your section called Wavelets, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you have a section of the book that talks about the North Carolina beach where you sometimes rent a little house. And you write, at the mouth of the inlet, these waves, keep rolling on, sculpting that edge of the island. Depending on tides, that edge can drop steeply into a fast current of slicing water, or it can be fantastically corrugated. Low tides, repeated ripples, creating gentle ribs of sand. This rippling pattern equals waves in miniature. When you fly over the ocean, you see the same seemingly small undulations. Once I translated the dramatic arc to a wave, I began to think that energy in narrative might also flow in smaller waves, wavelets. So I wanted to read that partly because I just wanted to share some of your lovely prose. I mean, I think that a book on narrative structure sounds much drier than this book actually is. I found it really just a wonderful read that pulled me forward. And then I wanted to just mention, so you talk about Raymond Carver's story, Where I'm Calling From, as a wonderful example of a piece that works in wavelets, whether or not he did it on purpose. And I loved reading again about this story and seeing it, you know, taken apart and analyzed. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that. It's about an alcoholic who is in... He's in rehab, and so you mention or you point out that Carver is working on this sort of dry and wet and dry wavelets. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That was actually I think that was one of the earlier stories I read that made me see other patterns, and it was really exciting at the time. Because he is, let's see, his character, who I don't think is named, he's the first person narrator, is at a drying out facility in the desert, and he is a wet brain, and it's a very, you know, it's a kind of typical Carver story in that not a whole lot happens, and there isn't any big fat change at the end, there's no epiphany, for God's sake, but there seems to be something else going on, and it was happening on a textural level, which was, I was, you know, when you read, I don't know how you are, but when I read, it probably goes back to that same sense of a felt motionless movement, but I can feel very bodily affected because I'm kind of, you know, I've got the words kind of in the back of my throat while I'm reading silently, and there was something going on in this story where a man is struggling not to be an alcoholic, and one of the things a lot of these men are doing to get, you know, to avoid alcohol is they're smoking a lot. And there was this sense in the story of kind of going through these passages where we're hearing about the alcoholic days and all of the gin and all of the beer, and then there's also a lot of rain, and there's just wetness, 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 and the next paragraph will take us back to the present in this drying out facility where they're in the desert and a dry wind is blowing and they're exhaling smoke and they're putting their ashes in a can, and one of them is remembering being trapped at the bottom of a dry well. Right. And I would just feel all that dryness just kind of like in my throat, literally. And then the next paragraph might be back to wet memories. And so I felt there's this odd kind of alternation going on. And in a way, that seems to reflect the struggle that this character has, which is unless he... Drying out to him feels like dying. It feels like being ashen or, inside a chimney or at the bottom of a dry well. But in this case, drying out is the only way he's going to live. And the wet is what kills him. And so the struggle going on inside of him that isn't articulated, it's just we know it, is I have to dry out or I'm going to die. Drying feels like dying, but it's what will keep me alive. And at the end, there's a passage which I will let people read about, where he realized that he finally is understanding fully that the wet is what will kill him. There's a kind of recalled passage from another story about snow falling on a flame and putting out the fire, and that's going to kill the man in the wilderness who's freezing to death. So there's a quiet way in which the conflict of the story, and I really hate that word because it's such a kind of conventional story word, but the tension of the story between the horror of being dry and the greater horror of being wet, a wet brain, is sort of resolved in this invisible background way, in the way that the passages are kind of alternating between the two, and then finally reaching a moment where the character is clearly seeing that in this case, the wet is the danger. I don't know if I've put that all that well, but it's...
No, I thought you did a really good job.
Great. Okay, good. Thank you. Because I don't think there's, you don't see any classic conflict on the page in incident. It's this kind of background textual shifting back and forth that finally settles itself out. And I kind of love how in that story, Raymond Carver, who I hope he meant it, but he has this final character pulling some change out of his pocket to call his wife. The story is where I'm calling from. And I just love that some change. That's all you're going to get is some change, a little change, not a great big change.
And when I say was he aware of it, I don't mean was he aware of what he was doing with the wet and dry, which seems fairly conscious. But no, I just mean as far as you're having seen it in wavelets, and you know, that's your interpretation of what he's doing, and did he recognize that there could be that analogy to wavelets? Maybe not, but I loved looking at it in that way.
Yeah, I did too, and then I have to admit that in terms of sort of being in this position where you're a writer and are you really conscious of the patterns you're using, I think that from now on I will be, but I certainly wasn't in my first few novels, but it was a reviewer, I think a San Francisco Chronicle reviewer, who described my second novel as being in little waves. Uh-huh. And I hadn't thought about that, although it was all about water. I mean, it was all about New Orleans and Venice and sea level rise and dissolution. And I did definitely structure it in little mini chapters with different characters, and there isn't really any big climactic thing. But I hadn't thought in terms of wavelets, and she brought that up, and this was 15 years ago, and I thought, oh my God, there was something in me that was moving toward that, but I had not articulated it yet. So I want to believe that sometimes the critic can actually point out something true that you didn't know.
definitely. I think that's definitely true. Now, another thing that you've found in your own work that you mentioned in this book, you say that you've found lyric memoir naturally follows a vortex, and you write, a preoccupied, haunted narrator turns around and around in her hands the most potent moments of her past, gazing at repeating patterns and shapes as she spins. So I wondered if you want to talk a little bit about that and about your experience writing lyric memoir.
Sure. I think I probably shouldn't have said if I said that it naturally does that and might naturally do that. It certainly did, I think, in my case where I did have a linear story to tell about my parents meeting another couple and trading partners and growing up with a double and just having this kind of strange mirrored life with this other girl. But I felt that in writing it, it was actually kind of interesting because I had never written memoir. I'd never written a personal essay. I'd never written in the first person. And this was my fourth book. And all of a sudden it was first person. It was about me. And it was really kind of a jarring thing to do. And my first draft of it was a straightforward linear accounting of things that had happened in time. And I gave it to my editor, and she said, well, this is okay as a draft, and now you need to make it the art, which was horrifying and very bracing news.
Yeah.
And so I had to rethink everything, and the incidents were going to be what they were. As far as I could remember them, I wanted to relay them. But what I had to do was just work on this really crucial thing that I think memoir needs, that Sven Burkert talks about beautifully in his book, The Art of Time in Memoir, and that Vivian Gornick talks about, and that is really manipulating the sort of double point of view of being the adult person now sitting somewhere calmly and looking back with emotion, but also with cooler, reflective eyes at the past, and then being also able to inhabit that younger self. So simultaneously, being here looking critically, ruminatively, hopefully intelligently at the person that you were 40, whatever, 30 years ago, who didn't know anything that was going to happen or didn't even know what was happening. So that made me start feeling that I was always kind of drawing the loop back to my adult self, and that started to feel a little bit spirally to me, because I would be kind of the adult, and then I'd circle back to the young girl, and then he would be the adult offering some more knowledge, and then kind of circle back to the young girl. And that's the kind of thing I saw happening in Jamaica Kincaid's Mr. Potter that I was talking about a minute ago, which is not a memoir, but it works in a similar way, where you have a very present adult authoritative narrator looking back at herself and at this man that she's creating. And it does have this kind of strange sense of looping, and the looping to me is spirally. And in terms of spiral, like a vortex, you know, you are moving somewhere. It's not just kind of senseless repetition. It's moving forward towards something, you know, like a vortex, something that's spinning around and around down, or maybe around and around up. But you are moving, but you have to kind of keep repeating certain things, like, you know, sometimes I wonder, am I look at this now? So I think that is what I mean when I say that a lyric memoir, one that is, I mean, lyric is often looking at repetitions anyway, and sort of rhythms that,
oh, sure,
and repeating sounds and movements. But that's how it was working with me. There are obsessive moments that you keep coming back to. And in my case with this memoir, it was, which of these parents did it first? You know, mm-hmm, a couple of traded partners very, very quickly. Who did it first? Because that was going to tell me more about my own power or authority or value or worth and my stepsisters. So that was a kind of recurring question. So that's the kind of thing I mean by it being lyric and obsessive and recurrent.
Yes, and I should correct myself. You do, in fact, say, I wonder if first-person retrospective narratives, especially obsessive ones, might naturally follow a vortex. I kind of shortened it in my question, and now I've gone back to the text, and in fact, you did say might.
I was thinking, that sounds awfully prescriptive. I mean, hell, I shouldn't do that.
Let's see. I was wondering if you've spoken with or had any response or feedback from any of these authors who are still living today.
Oh, you mean about things I had to say about their work? No.
Yeah. No.
I don't think so. No, I've met Nicholson Baker and talked with him, but we didn't get to that because the book wasn't out yet. I was shy.
Right. Well, it's awkward to say, you should read my book about your book.
That's right. Let me give you something new to know. No, I haven't. I don't think I have. No, my editor, who was Jamaica King, I keep talking about Jamaica King, but it's because I think she's great, but she was her original editor for all of her first books, and she said, I think she would appreciate this. But
okay.
I don't know because she hasn't called me up to say so.
Now, I was also curious if it was complicated to get permissions to use these pieces.
It just costs money.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful one of my graduate students, Nicole Lefebvre, worked with me on the book a lot, and she fed me all kinds of essays and books that I needed to read, and she also took over all the permissions, and she is a genius at that. So you just have to write letters and request permission and show exactly the passages you want and how long the book will be and on and on, and then they send you back how much they want you to pay, and you say okay. And so, yeah, it just takes time and costs quite a little bit of money, which
yeah,
is what research funds at universities can be used for, luckily.
Yeah, and you never had anybody sort of saying, well, we don't like the way you're interpreting this, like that wasn't part of it, or?
No, I don't think they even read it. I don't think they bothered reading it. I don't think they would.
Right, because it's not the authors who hold the rights, is it?
Yeah, right. Well, in some cases it is, and you have to ask permission. No, that didn't happen. And maybe, I mean, it could still, I don't know, but it hasn't happened because it was clearly a kind of an academic book.
Sure.
And it was more analytical than anything else. And no, didn't happen yet.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to just ask, I always ask this of all of my guests, what you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Let's see. I just read Hong Kong's The White Book, which I thought was beautiful. I had read her The Vegetarian a couple years ago when that came out or was translated. And so this one is really beautiful and very mysterious, and where it lives between fiction and so-called nonfiction, I have no idea, but I don't care. that's really lovely and moving and strange. And also Hernán Díaz's In the Distance, which came out a few years ago, I just read, which has a plot, but it's so meandering and slow. It's wonderful, and it involves someone who's in isolation almost all the time, and he pulls it off beautifully.
Oh, wow.
So let's see. Those are two of my recent favorites, yes.
Great. So, Jane, I also wondered what you're writing these days.
Well, I'm working on a book, which is one that, it's actually interesting when you ask the question about structure and having it ahead of time. It's something that I drafted some years ago, and so was working on quite hard, and it's I don't, if you remember the beginning of Meander Spiral, there's a section about the Irish designer Eileen Gray and a house she built on the south coast of France that the Swiss architect Le Corbusier became obsessed with.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get a novel, whether it's a kind of hybrid nonfiction novel or not, I'm still struggling with, But I am returning to that on sabbatical, and that is my task. And having written drafts of it, I really do have the material. I mean, I have so much already of what the text is going to be. But I've never been happy with the structure or the point of view. And an interviewer asked me recently whether I was going to be very conscious about using natural forms in my own work. And I thought, well, maybe I better. And this one, I think, is coming as a spiral. And so I'm trying to think of how I can both make it feel like a real and vivid work, but also have that structure behind it. So I'm testing myself on that very hoisted upon my or by my own petard, I think.
Yeah. interesting, though, because the architecture, the story being about architecture could naturally lead into like more of a house structure. But
yeah, yeah. But one cool thing is that the house, you know, it actually has a spiral staircase that almost kind of screws it into the rock that it's
cool.
on the rocks. I'm going to work with that for a little while, see how it goes.
Yeah,
you're right. I should try and be open and not. But I really did try and get things done before, and I just was never happy. So it's not a very friendly relationship I'm having with it at the moment. But
sorry. But do you, I was curious if you have a lot of background information on her and on that project and on his reaction to it. And I mean, are there lots of journal entries or letters written or do you have that sort of material?
Yes, I have. I think all the material I could want for a long. I mean, I've been to the site twice. I'm actually going again next week because now her house is more open to the public than it was. And I've visited all the houses that he has made and, you know, a few other works of hers. And I've read extensively on both of them. She had burned a lot of her materials and was very private. And so there wasn't much of an entree into what she really felt. But recently, or in the last couple of years, an archivist in Ireland who had access to materials that had not been known before, has published a book about her. And I'm waiting for that book to arrive today. So I can see a little bit more. But one of the problems is sometimes you get to, it's kind of like being caught in a structure when, when you're that wedded to what is real, it can impede what you're trying to do inventively. So I'm trying to walk that line as well and not make it too much of a kind of, you know, a live enactment of real, of, you know, something historic.
Yeah, it's kind of like doing too much research. You know, you don't want
exactly.
that.
Yeah.
To infuse like too much detail of some random thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's see. I have a couple last questions for you. I like to finish up by asking for advice. My show is for writers as well as readers. And so I wonder if you could offer advice for writers who are trying to find the structure for something they're already working on, and I guess advice for being open to structural ideas, and maybe infusing structure into an existing work.
I think that if you're working on something already, and especially because I've had conversations with people in the last few months who have been working on something and they've just gotten to a point where they're stuck and they're struggling and they're miserable, and we all know what that's like. But I think that if structure is what the problem is, and so a few people I've spoken to were, someone was feeling really trapped by the arc, and we were talking, and then she suddenly realized, I do not have to be trapped by the arc. I can look at what I've actually got and see what sort of pattern is emerging from it. So to see what other pattern might be the one that the story, the narrative really wants, I think look and see where you have any kind of repetitions. How it's moving in time. Does it seem to be moving kind of rapidly forward in time, or is it really not? Does it seem to be more curious about excavating the past? Because if it's doing that, it might be something that is more spirally, for instance. What is the emotional heart? Is it kind of really like hot and wild? It could be something that needs to be more fragmented. You know, maybe it's the kind of material that will resist a sort of smooth telling and instead has to be kind of exploded in fragments. So some of those things I think I would do. I would look at what I've actually got, what my material is, and try and, dissect what's already there and look for repetitions, look for movement in time, and look for, you know, the sort of emotional temperature.
Okay, wonderful. So I just want to mention again, the name of the book is Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative by Jane Allison and published by Catapult. Jane, thank you very much for speaking with me today. I've found your book fascinating and I really enjoyed speaking about it with you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you, too, and I'm looking forward to reading your book with its musical structure.
Nope. Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Jane Allison. You can learn more about her work at janeallisonauthor.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jane Allison, who led a workshop recently that was studying Grace Paley's story, Distance. There's a phrase in the story that has, as a part of it, quote, the picture in the muck under their skulls. Jane loved this line. She says, we all have such pictures in the muck under our skulls. Those moments that have formed or deformed us, that haunt us, maybe places we want to return to or moments that will not leave us alone. So this week, think if there's some moment or image from your recent or long ago past, a deeply embedded thing that, as Jane puts it, can still glimmer before your eyes or make you feel homesick or has a mysterious potency to it. A moment that could become an important part of a story about your life or perhaps part of a story that you would invent about someone like you. Write about it, let its magnetism lead you as you work, and see what comes out of the muck. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I want to share with you that Vermont Coffee Company, WIZN, and Ben & Jerry's present Salvation Farms Aid Friday, November 1st, and you can learn more information at artsriot.com. As always, I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And on that website, you'll also find information about my ongoing book giveaway. Just look for that labeled tab on the top of my homepage to learn more about what I do with the books that I get for the show. I give them away. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.